This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
February the 28th marked Rare Disease Day, which since 2008 has been drawing attention to the need for better diagnosis and treatment of these conditions. I'm Harry Brooks, content manager at LGIM, and today I'm joined by ETF analyst Ellie Piscopiello to discover how research and development of potentially life-changing treatments for rare conditions is funded. Ellie, should we start by explaining what's meant by the term rare disease? Is there a standard internationally agreed definition? And what type of conditions are we talking about here?
So various definitions exist for rare diseases. In the US, it's a disease that affects under 200,000 people, or one every 1,700 people. In the EU, a rare disease is one that affects less than one person every 2,000 people. Approximately 70% of rare diseases are genetic, and they normally manifest in very young age. So for example, children. Some rare diseases that we commonly know and experience are cancer and Alzheimer's disease. Unfortunately, one every five cancers is rare. And this has an impact not only on the patients, but also on the relatives and the families of these people. I believe this is something that we've all experienced, either ourselves or with relatives. And there are actually different opinions on what makes a cancer rare. In Europe and the UK, for instance, it's a cancer that affects less than six in 100,000 people. And about a quarter of cancers that are diagnosed every year are considered to be rare. And what makes them particularly concerning is that their symptoms are less usual and recognizable compared to other types of more common cancers. So they're really hard to catch early. And there is a longer wait as well after they're identified to a longer wait for the results of these tests. So they have a longer time frame to be caught. And then trials are also more complex because it takes more time to recruit for people. And since there are little participants, the significance of results can be impacted.
Great, thanks. So that's really helpful to put these rare diseases in some sort of context that I think we can all relate to when you talked about cancer and Alzheimer's particularly, that just because the specific condition might be a rare disease, the broader category of conditions is one that we're all very familiar with. I wonder if we can move on to talk about the journey that the treatments take from the initial discovery behind a medical treatment option to a packet of pills that you or I could go down to the pharmacy and collect. What are the various stages that are involved in that process?
Nature is often the starting place, although now new processes are originating directly from lab research, so synthetically. And nature has been the starting place from before modern medicine times, from ancient times when people would use plants and naturally occurring elements to treat diseases and develop new cures. In terms of timeline, there is an initial stage of research, normally in universities and research labs, in which scientists try to identify targets for new treatments. Then they search for the molecule and compounds that can fight this target. And then there is a long process of trial phases. You might have heard of clinical trial phase one, phase two, phase three, and so on. But that initial stage of discovery is very, very exciting. And treatments can sometimes be found in unexpected places. So I mentioned nature, and as an example, there is a company that today is exploring the oceans with the aim of creating cancer drugs based on marine invertebrates, such as sponges, mollusks, and crustaceans, because they lack immune systems and therefore could provide novel approaches to combating cancer in humans. This companies like this have teams that organize marine expeditions. They can collect, study new organisms and develop these new cures in a synthetic environment, either in vitro or in vivo. And then after this, initial phase, as I mentioned, there are all the phases, all the trials. So they start from phase one, when these substances, these compounds, are given to healthy individuals to check if they're any harmful. Then there is a phase two, when it is checked whether they work on patients. Then there is a phase three, where they are given to a wider patient population. And after this, there's lots of other steps. So there's marketing approvals and other tests to see, for example, if these compounds can be given to pregnant women or if they can be available in national health services. So all this research, all these steps, all these times and investment is actually quite a lot for rare diseases, given that they affect a relatively smaller part of the population compared to more common diseases.
So I understand that the cost of bringing new drugs to market, as you explained, is a really significant cost for companies developing new drugs, and that the sector has also been hit with a wave of patent expiries over recent years, perhaps decades, which has left the pharmaceutical sector as a whole under mounting financial pressure in recent years. Given that treatments for the rare diseases that we're talking about here today inherently have got a more limited market than mainstream medicines, how can their development be economical for the drugs companies?
Governments do recognize that the small number of people affected by rare diseases means additional incentives are needed to fund the development of these treatments. And understanding how treatments for rare diseases are funded actually begins with the term orphan drug. So what exactly is an orphan drug? We've explained what a disease is, but also for orphan drugs, different countries have different interpretations. The European Medicine Agency, for example, defines an orphan drug as one that aims to cure, prevent, or treat diseases that are potentially fatal and result in chronic debilitation. This disease should not affect more than 5 in 10,000 people, and the treatment must result in significant improvement in the patient's condition. So if a drug then secures this orphan status, there are various incentives that come into play.
Okay, I wonder if you can tell us a bit about what type of incentives companies are able to access if they qualify for orphan drug status. Is it just help with research and development costs, or is it help that extends beyond that initial phase?
There are a lot of different incentives that vary in terms of geography. Starting from Europe, this type of medicines can benefit from protocol assistance, so orphan-specific scientific advice from the European Medicine Agency. These phases, these drugs, development processes, can have access to a centralized authorization procedure. These drugs can get up to 10 years of market exclusivity. And there are also some fee reductions for regulatory activities when applying, and additional incentives for micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises. In Japan, up to 50% of development costs can get reimbursed. And in the US, once a drug is granted orphan status by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, it qualifies for incentives that include tax credits, exemption from user fees, and up to 7 years of market exclusivity after approval.
Okay, so having looked at the backdrop for orphan drugs in terms of the development process and the help that national agencies can provide, should we turn to the investment case for the orphan drug space in general? Have the incentives that have been put into place nationally, internationally, have those incentives translated into capital flows into the sector?
According to Evaluate Pharma, a leading drugs industry analyst, the orphan drug market is growing over twice as fast as the non-orphan market, with a projected rate of growth annually between 2021 and 2026 of 12%. By 2026, they estimate that orphan drug sales will account for 20% of all prescription drug sales at $273 billion. Given this encouraging outlook, with the difficulties in the generic drug space, such as competitiveness and pressure on IP, it's quite unsurprising that many of the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies are investing heavily in orphan drugs.
Great. For investors who are interested in this part of the market, what are some of the pros and cons to keep in mind?
First of all, it's important to remember that the incentives that are offered by the FDA, its European equivalent, and others around the world that were mentioned, they can change. So taking a global approach could mitigate the impact of policy shifts in any given region. For example, we have seen in the US some impact after the announcements and developments on Medicare. In terms of potential benefits at portfolio level, the returns from orphan drug developers have historically been less correlated to macro events compared to other areas of the market and more dependent on progress on clinical trials and M&A activity, meaning that this type of theme could help improve diversification in a portfolio. Then there are many exposures to pharma. They vary from traditional healthcare to technology, genomics, or other specific areas. And for growth investors, it's important to choose an area with promising developments and a reasonable level of diversification with regards to therapy areas.
Well, thanks very much for your time today, Ellie. That's been a really interesting look at this important part of the market. And thank you for taking the time to explain the complexities of it to a complete non-specialist like me. And thanks to all our listeners as well.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2022. Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.